From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After being forced to tell her story to the grand jury and the Senate, Monica Lewinsky is giving a few interviews to the American press to promote her new book, Monica's Story. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear the interview I recorded with her yesterday, which took a surprising turn. Also, this is National Poetry Month. We'll feature an interview with Philip Levine and hear some of his great poems about working. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the National Endowment for the Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When we were told by Monica Lewinsky's publisher that she was going to do a few more interviews to promote her book, Monica's Story, and that one of those interviews could be on Fresh Air, I had a really ambivalent reaction. I thought, what's left to talk about? Isn't it time for this story to end? And how would I handle the sexual aspects of the story? Her intimate relationship with the president is at the center of the story, and it's a central part of her book. But if I asked about it, would that make me a good journalist or a voyeur? And if I avoided that territory and stuck to questions about her life after the impeachment, would that just be fluff? Well, those reservations were overruled by the slightly louder voice in my head that said, how can you turn down an opportunity to talk with Monica Lewinsky? So, yesterday, I recorded an interview with Monica Lewinsky. Here's how it went. I'll confess that I'm very ambivalent about interviewing you. I really wanted to talk with you, yet I don't want to be one of the people who drags on the story after it's over, and I don't want to be one of the people who tries to make public things that should rightfully be private. I wonder if you're ambivalent about doing interviews now.
Most definitely. I think it was a hard experience for me to have everything become public when I didn't want it to, and then choosing to put my version of events on the record for people and what comes with that in terms of interviews and whatnot is sometimes it's a little bit stressful for me emotionally.
It must be strange after being forced to talk by the special prosecutor's office in the Senate to then be obliged to give interviews to promote the book.
I think it's something that I've gotten much more used to in the past 6 weeks since we started the book tour and did that in the UK and in Europe. And I've certainly learned a lot. But sometimes it is difficult for me. And sometimes you don't want to do that. But at the same time, what's been important to me is that I've been judged a lot on things that weren't true. And if people are going to choose to judge me, I'd at least prefer that they judge me on the truth.
The story is still continuing. Judge Susan Weber Wright recently found the president in contempt of court for giving false, misleading, and evasive answers that were designed to obstruct the judicial process. Now, in your Paula Jones deposition, you said, I have never had a sexual relationship with the president. He did not propose that we have a sexual relationship. I'm wondering, do you think of that as a lie?
Depends on how carefully you want to, split hairs or parse the statement. I think it was misleading. It was definitely misleading.
And you knew what you were doing, or what you hope to accomplish, by saying something that was misleading. What was your rationalization for it?
I think I had sort of two states of mind at that point. One was I really felt that I was going to do whatever I needed to do to protect the privacy of this relationship. And at the same time, I was able to rationalize to myself that in some senses, what was in there was literally true. And in that sense, it was misleading.
I'm wondering if you felt that the more important principle that you wanted to honor was the principle of protecting your privacy and protecting the president.
Certainly. I think that for me, and I know I've been asked a lot, people tend to have not understand how I could feel that this shouldn't be talked about publicly, yet I had confided in some of my friends. And I think that there's a big difference between when someone confides something privately and in private and when they say something in public. And I felt that this was certainly something that should remain private.
There was a story in last Sunday's New York Times that at the time Kosovo was really needing attention, earlier before the full-scale ethnic cleansing started there, that President Clinton was very distracted by the impeachment process. Do you feel that your relationship with the president had consequences that you couldn't even imagine while the relationship was going on?
Well, I think without directly commenting about that situation, and I didn't see the article, I was out of the country, in so many different respects, I think this clearly this relationship had a lot more consequences than I could have ever have imagined.
Everyone has their own version of the story and their own moral to the story. I'd love to talk with you about your interpretation. As you write about in the book and as you've spoken about before, you kind of initiated the relationship by flashing your thong underwear and signaling, "I'll play," to the president, and then confessing to him that you had a crush on him. And then he followed through on those signals that he perhaps should have ignored. Do you feel that either of you is any more responsible in starting this relationship?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily a completely accurate description of how it began. So I think...
Fix it for me.
Okay. If anybody, a lot of times I think if people were to step away from the situation and look at it as a man and a woman instead of the president and the intern, and think about in their own lives when a relationship, whether it's one that they should or shouldn't have, begins, the flirtation started with eye contact, and it moved onto different levels. And I know that people have really kind of attached themselves to the thong incident, and it was something that was very subtle. It was in a room full of other people, and it was not. Yes, it was certainly a forward move. Yes, it was certainly, as you quoted me as having saying, sort of being a message of, "Yes, I'll play." But there had already been flirtation that had existed for a few months. So I think it was taking it to another level. And the step that you're missing in between the thong and then me telling him that I had a crush on him was him inviting me into an office where there was no one else present. So I think that in some respects, that was the biggest move that he made.
Inviting you in.
And this was into George Stephanopoulos's office.
So you see that as kind of an invitation?
I think so. I think that certainly took it to a much higher level, and I responded.
The president has said about your relationship with him in one of his apologies that he understands that he has sinned. And I'm wondering if you see the relationship as a sin or if you see it in any larger religious or moral way.
I think I probably see it as being more morally incorrect. And I certainly it was a sin. I'm not the most religious person, in all honesty. I think I'm more spiritual than I am religious. And it certainly was morally wrong.
Did you, when the relationship was going on, ever think about what the consequences might be for you, for the president, for his family, and for the country?
Yes and no. I think that people need to understand that when I thought about worst-case scenarios, all I could have ever imagined was that there would have been an allegation made publicly, not by me, not by him. I would have denied it publicly, and he would have denied it publicly. So it would have been a problem, and it was also something that I didn't anticipate. It of course, crossed my mind, but I never thought it would be something that would ever be confirmed to the public or to the country or to his family, because I certainly wasn't going to confirm it.
What was the worst case scenario that you played in your head?
I think was that, well, either that the result of some of the rumors that were circling the White House would get into the press, and that it would be an issue that way, and I would just flat out deny it and say it was ridiculous, or that maybe someone I had confided in might betray me, and in which case that would be going to the press, and I would once again deny it.
So you were confident that just denying things would end the story?
Yes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Monica Lewinsky, and as you know, she has a new book called Monica's Story. As I mentioned, you know, a lot of people have different interpretations about what your story means, and also different scenarios for what you represent as a woman. One scenario, and this is the Monica Lewinsky's Bad for Women version, that scenario is that you were a woman who thought that you could find self-esteem by sleeping with men, but you usually got involved with the wrong men. Mm-hmm. The Monica Lewinsky is, a kind of interesting development for women version goes like this. Monica Lewinsky is a woman who takes unapologetic pleasure in her sexuality. What do you think about both of those versions?
Probably the truth lies somewhere in a combination of the two. I think that I haven't made a secret about it, that I am comfortable with my sexuality, but that doesn't take away from the fact that I have some personal issues that and emotional issues that I need to work on, and that clearly the, I guess the result of some of those issues was that I was involved in relationships I shouldn't have been. I think that... what I found what's interesting, I mean, in what you're saying about women is just that on one hand, there's been so much support, and I've received a lot of support from women and some of the most vocal support, and it's been private support that I've gotten from women. But publicly, it has been the women who have been, I guess, my harshest critic.
Has a story... You know, has your relationship and its consequences gotten you to rethink your own sense of your own sexuality and your own sense of what a kind of healthy relationship is?
Certainly. I think that the result of this past year has certainly put me in a position where I know that I definitely needed to and have taken the action to begin working on my personal and private issues so that those things don't happen again.
What do you mean by those things?
Having relationships with men I shouldn't be having.
Right. Now that your personal life has been the subject of every kind of press imaginable, do you think a lot of people are hypocritical about sex?
Definitely.
What are some of the things you've found most striking in that area?
I think the first thing that comes to mind would probably be the media and the way so many journalists or people on TV would talk about this and, this tawdry affair and this, that, and the other when they themselves in their personal lives have made similar mistakes. And I think that was something that the hypocrisy came out as well in the impeachment trial within Congress.
How did you feel about Larry Flynt's investigation into the private lives of senators and congressmen?
I had mixed feelings about it. I thought on the one hand, I was glad someone was going to bring this hypocrisy to light. But on the other hand, having had this experience of having my private life exposed when I didn't want it to, it's a very invasive feeling. So I thought that it was a bit cruel.
Monica Lewinsky is my guest, and as you know, she has a new book called Monica's Story. Let's talk a little bit about what you believe the relationship with President Clinton was about. You've described the president as your sexual soulmate, and yet he had told you that he had had hundreds of affairs before he was 40, but after he was 40, he'd made a concerted effort to be faithful. Then he confessed to you that he kept a record of the days he didn't cheat on his wife. So when you hear something like that from someone, what delusions can you have about the specialness of your relationship?
Well, I think first let me just correct, because only in fairness to him, that... he said my recollection of what he had said was that he had kept a record of the days he had been good. And so I think to go a step further and say that his being good was necessarily days that he didn't cheat on his wife is kind of a jump that's a little bit too much to make. And it's not really fair to him or to Mrs. Clinton. I think I felt that also at the time when he sort of said hundreds of affairs, that I didn't necessarily think that was literal, that there were 100 other women. but I don't know. I think for me that it was understanding, and it was seeing that we had some sort of a connection, and the connection started, it was a physical attraction. There was an attraction there, and it developed into a lot of other things that mm-hmm. come from being intimate with someone, not just physically, but emotionally.
You describe in the book that the first time you engaged in oral sex, he talked with a congressman on the phone about Bosnia. And at the same time, while that's happening, you're thinking, we clicked at an incredible level. And, reading that, I just couldn't help but wonder how he could be on the phone while this is happening and you're thinking about how incredibly well you're clicking.
I certainly am not going to go through and reenact for you verbally what was going on and what my feelings and emotions were at the time. I think you just have to accept at face value that that's how I was feeling and that that's what was going on for me.
We're listening to the interview I recorded yesterday with Monica Lewinsky. As you could probably hear, she wasn't very comfortable with that question about clicking with the president. My next question was going to explore similar territory, but after the first few words of the question, Lewinsky told me that my questions were too intimate and that she didn't want to continue the interview. She seemed to be under the impression that our conversation was supposed to be limited to subjects like her book tour and her recent experiences in Europe. She wasn't hostile. She even apologized for having to end the interview, but end it she did. I suppose this wasn't a surprising conclusion to an interview that the interviewer was ambivalent about conducting and the interviewee was uncomfortable participating in. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is National Poetry Month, and poet laureate Robert Pinsky has been appointed to serve a third term, which is unprecedented. He's continuing work on his favorite poem project, which he initiated in his first term. He's getting people from all walks of life to read their favorite poems onto tape. This is an excerpt of our 1997 interview about the use of rhyme in poetry. Let me ask you, when you're dealing with rhyme, how much are you willing to deal with something more like harmony rather than rhyme exactly?
That's it. That's what you do. As I say, thinking about end rhyme isn't the only thing. There's a wonderful sentence in Frost's unrhymed poem, An Old Man's Winter Night, where he says, "A light it was to no one but himself where now he sat, a quiet light, and then not even that." Well, those T's go off beautifully. A light he was to no one but himself, where now he sat, concerned with he knew what, a quiet light, and then not even that. And it's not in rhyme, they're not end rhymes. The what and the at and the quiet and the light.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A light he was to no one but himself, where now he sat, concerned with he knew what, a quiet light, and then not even that. Is that rhyme? I don't know. It's a degree of likeness that's very taking in the poem.
While we're talking about rhyme, I want you to read a short poem of yours that has rhymes within, and it's called An Old Man. Can you talk with us before reading it about why you wanted this to rhyme?
Well, it's only sort of by me. It's based on my reading of translations of Konstantin Kavafi's poem, An Old Man. A poem I loved in translation for many years, and I knew from reading the notes in the Sheridan Keeley and in the Ray Dalvin translations that it was in a very complicated rhyme scheme. And one day I got the notion I could do it. I call it An Old Man After Cavafy, and it's pretty close to what Cavafy wrote, but I can't read Greek. It's, you know, it's my poem based on the translations. I don't know whether to call it a translation or a poem. An Old Man After Cavafy. Back in a corner, alone in the clatter and babble, an old man sits with his head bent over a table and his newspaper in front of him in the cafe. Sour with old age, he ponders a dreary truth. How little he enjoyed the years when he had youth, good looks and strength and clever things to say. He knows he's quite old now. He feels it, he sees it, and yet the time when he was young seems, was it yesterday? How quickly it slipped away. Now he sees how discretion has betrayed him and how stupidly he let the liar persuade him with phrases. Tomorrow, there's plenty of time. Someday. He recalls the pull of impulses he suppressed, the joy he sacrificed, every chance he lost, ridicules his brainless prudence a different way. But all these thoughts and memories have made the old man dizzy. He falls asleep, his head resting on the table in the noisy cafe.
Poet laureate Robert Pinsky. His latest books include The Sounds of Poetry and The Handbook of Heartbreak. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's National Poetry Month. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Levine. His poems are drawn from his memories. We'll hear him read poems based on his years of factory work in Detroit, poems about fire and sweat.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Saab, designing cars with the notion that performance and safety go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. And Bantam Books, publisher of Joseph E. Stevens' 1863, The Rebirth of a Nation, chronicling the year that shaped America's destiny, available in hardcover.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. April is National Poetry Month, and poet Philip Levine has a new collection called The Mercy. His previous book won a Pulitzer Prize. In an earlier review in the New York Times, Levine was described as a large, ironic Whitman of the industrial heartland, loyal to his roots in Detroit, determined to remember the exhausted and enraged worker, the unlucky immigrant, the man who gasps for breath and asks, "Am I going to make it?" Philip Levine worked in many factories in Detroit as a young man. Now work means writing poems and teaching. But the sweat and fire of factory work have been the subject of many compelling poems. I spoke to him in 1991 after the publication of his collection of poems called What Work Is. He told me that work is an important theme in his poems because most of his poetry originates in his memories. He did heavy manual labor from the age of 14 to 29. Before he reads the poem What Work Is, here's the story behind it.
I never worked at Ford Highland Park, which I mentioned in the poem, but I went there once for a job during a period in the early 50s in Detroit when there was a kind of a slight recession, so a lot of people got laid off, although Detroit was a booming town back then. And I waited in line, and it was raining, and it was a long wait. You know, the newspaper would advertise, you know, assemblers. That's the lowest job you can get. And they would put hours down, like 8 to 5. But you knew you had to be there early if you were going to get a job. And so you got there maybe 7:30. Well, they didn't open the employment office till, say, 9. So you stood there for an hour and a half before anything even opened. And there were 50 people ahead of you. But that was in a way to, you know, they wanted to test you. You know, how much crap could you take? I mean, were you willing to wait in line that long? If you weren't, they didn't want you. And so I, as I waited, I grew angrier and angrier at myself for being this humble character. And finally, maybe about 10:30 or so, I got up to the head of the line. And there was a guy sitting down. I was standing. We each went to a different desk. We stood, they sat. And he said, "What kind of job would you like?" And I don't know where this impulse came from, but I said, "I want your job."
Oh, gee.
And he said, "Okay, take off." And that was it. But I was sort of happy that there was this thing in me that was still there that, you know, said, you know, I don't want you and you don't want me. And so I suppose that I never forgot that moment of standing there all that time and then being, you know, a smart mouth.
Did you have the money to afford to mouth off like that and lose the pay for the day?
No. No, I didn't. I remember I went to Chevrolet Gear and Axle, which was an awful place, later that day and got another got a job there, which was just as bad. You know, it was just as bad a place. I was married at the time. I had to make a living. I had responsibilities. So I really couldn't afford to be who I wanted to be. You know? Let me read the poem. What Work Is. We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead, a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today, for any reason he wants." You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him, held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek? You've never done something so simple, so obvious. Not because you're too young or too dumb. Not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No, just because you don't know what work is.
When did you start writing about your experiences in factories? Were you still in factories when you were writing poems?
I was unable to write any poetry about my working life while that was my working life. I tried a few times, and the poems were hysterical. I think they were just, you know, I couldn't control them. My anger was so overwhelming that I couldn't cope with it. Just as I couldn't write about my boyhood very effectively until I was, 40. It was still too powerful for me. But I'm patient, so I hung in there, and that's probably my chief virtue as a writer, is my patience. So I waited, and I kept trying to write about factory work, but I kept throwing the poems away. And the first poem I ever published about working in a factory, I was, 31 or 2. But I don't like the poem anymore.
Can you give me a sense of what was going wrong in the factory poems when you were still there? Is there anything?
Yes, okay. Yes, I can. The language was overblown. I wanted to use the word eternity, and I wanted to use a kind of Latin diction, almost a Miltonic diction, and a great chorus. Build up a great chorus of sound and to dramatize the horror show of some of the places I'd worked. And I didn't have any, there was no tenderness in it for the people that I worked with. There was no, that was part of the reward that I got for those years, was the people I was meeting, even though you didn't talk to them that much because the places were often so loud. But you'd meet them afterwards, or you'd make friends with them and spend time with them. And they weren't getting in the poems at all. The poems were, my poor soul being hammered out of shape by General Motors. And they were a bit self-indulgent. <you know. laughs>
My guest is poet Philip Levine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1991 interview with poet Philip Levine. What was your final goodbye to factory work?
My final goodbye was, it came when my first wife left me, which is why I always love the word goodbye. And I didn't have to do this. Also, I wasn't in debt, and it just suddenly occurred to me, she's gone. I don't owe anybody anything. I'm going to quit. I'm going to live on my wits, and or try. And so I started to try to live on my wits, and sure enough, I've done it.
So what did
that? Not too well all the time, but you know.
When you decided to live on your wits, where did you go? What did you do for money?
Well, actually, I took a job with my brother. I don't want to describe it because he'd get mad at me. And for a long summer, and I could live like a little church mouse. And then I went off to the University of Iowa to study poetry writing with Robert Lowell. And I thought there was a fellowship there for me. And when I got there, I was a year late, and the fellowship had been given to somebody else, even though I'd written them and said, hold it for me. And so I never registered. I just took courses without paying for them and kept saying, oh, that information will get to you soon. And I studied with Robert Lowell and then John Berryman. And John Berryman was a great teacher, just a great teacher. And I never needed another teacher after that. So I had a year of studying with two terrific poets. Not living particularly well. Then I met my second wife. She wasn't my wife when I met her. She was just a lucky single woman. And we got married, and my wife worked for a while. When our second child came, I started teaching then. And by this time, I'd published enough poetry to get a job teaching. And I'd finished a master's degree through the Mayo from Wayne University. So I lucked in there. I got this terrific woman. I mean, she's not just that she supported me. She's also a marvelous woman.
You've written a lot of poems that where your brother figures into the poem.
Yeah.
Do you see your brother as like the alternate version of your life or something? You know, like somebody who you could have been and you're not, or I mean, like what function do you see your brother as serving, almost as metaphor or something within your poems?
Yeah, you know, first thing, I'm an identical twin.
Ah.
And I didn't realize how significant this was in my poetry. I have a great many poems in which men have these encounters with each other and a couple poems in which they embrace very deeply, they hold each other. And I think that a lot of that, I remember a guy writing a wonderful man named David Calstone, who's dead now, writing a review of one of my books and talking about these encounters and how powerful they were or how powerful he felt they were. And it was that review that opened my eyes to the fact that, of course, the roots of that are that the terrible wrenching away from my twin brother. I grew up half believing I was half a person. It's very curious to grow up as an identical twin. Not sure that I was the whole person. Maybe I was me and him both. Or me, you know, it's very difficult to describe. But I don't think since I was five I've ever felt that anything as close as I'd felt up to that time. Maybe six or seven, when we began to drift apart. And I remember when I first started writing poetry, it was enormously, I was about, actually I didn't show my brother the first poems I wrote. I didn't show him poems until I was about 17 or so. And he loved them. He just loved them. And he would take, he's a bigger guy than I, and he's more aggressive physically and in every other way. And he would take these poems and show them to people and say, what do you think? Isn't this great? That's what he would say. Isn't this great? And, of course, they'd say, yeah, because he was kind of an intimidating guy. My brother's a great poet. And in some ways, it was the high point of my writing career. I mean, I had one reader, and he was absolutely mad for what I was doing. Now I have many more readers, but I don't know if any of them, you know, are so totally taken with what I write. I was really writing totally for two people, myself and my brother. Since then, I've discovered others. But it was quite amazing.
You said that you were wrenched away from your twin brother. When were you wrenched away?
I was afraid you'd ask that. I just felt at a certain point in my life that when I was quite young, that I had to be myself. I began to make discoveries about him, that he wasn't me. There were ways in which he reacted to experiences. I could see that it was they just weren't my reactions. And so a time came when I said, I can't go on with this. I have to find out my own identity and live it. And so I suppose the wrenching was something I imposed upon myself. My guess is he probably felt something similar. I do think there were times when our inmost thoughts were communicated to each other without our speaking. We were that close.
I want to get back to something you said early in the interview.
Sure.
You said that, then this is when you were, waiting online for factory jobs and knowing that you might get turned down. You said you couldn't afford to be who you wanted to be. And I think within that sentence is a pretty interesting class analysis about identity. You know what I mean? That it takes a certain amount of money in a way to live, not only to live the life you want, but to be who you want to be.
That's right. That's right. I mean, for example, I was politically very conscious. I was aware of exploitation. I remember my brother and I, at about age 10, swearing we would never exploit other people. We would never live off the labor of other people in a way in which they were abused and we were given an advantage on their hard work. And I remember when I worked for a General Motors factory once, you had to take these IQ tests before you started working. And they said, we'd like to put you into our management program. You've done very well on this IQ test. I lied and said I'd never gone to college or they'd never hire you. And they said, gee, these scores are wonderful. And I said, no. And they said, we would send you to Flint, Michigan. You go to a school there. We have a slavery school there. You'll be taught really how to torture people effectively and subtly, and we'll pay you twice as much, and when you're done, we'll give you a suit and a tie. Wouldn't you like to do that? I said, no, I just like to be a slave myself. I mean, I didn't like being a slave, but I had taken an oath that I wasn't going to exploit people, and my brother was watching me. I couldn't break it. He's a very stubborn guy, so it was a determination we made. It would be nice to be able to afford it. Of course, then what do you have to do? You have to change the world so that lots of people can take that oath and live it, right? And how did I choose to change the world so that was more possible? I wrote poetry. And I actually thought, and this will strike you, Terry, as idiotic. That writing poetry would be a means of changing the world. Because what I was reading was changing me so radically. Nothing in my life had as much power over me as what I read, both poetry and fiction. And when I began, too, I wanted to be a novelist as well as a poet. Then, of course, when I published my first book in an edition of 220, I said to myself, gee whiz, this is a big country for 220 books.
Would you feel that in some ways poetry is obsolete for a lot of people because they have movies and TV and songs to tell their stories?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. By this time, I didn't care, because by this time, I had fallen in love with the poem, and I loved writing it, and I didn't care. I mean, it was what I had to do, and whether it changes people or whether it doesn't, it's what I have to do.
Philip Levine, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's nice. It's a pleasure.
Philip Levine recorded in 1991 after the publication of his collection of poems, What Work Is. His new collection is called The Mercy. This is Fresh Air. Well, you can't say we don't believe in variety. Our guests today have included Monica Lewinsky and poet Philip Levine. Earlier this week, we talked about acting with Dustin Hoffman, the global economy with Tom Friedman, and life after the fatwa with Salman Rushdie. Where else on the radio but public radio could you find this kind of programming? Please call and support it with a pledge. Thank you so much. The new movie, Election, is a comedy set in a high school starring Matthew Broderick and Reese Witherspoon. Our film critic, John Powers, has this review.
High school movies come in two kinds. Those made for high school kids and those made about them. The wonderful new comedy, Election, is one of the latter. It takes the least enticing of subjects, high school elections in Omaha, Nebraska, and turns it into a hilariously revealing portrait of middle American life. Matthew Broderick plays Jim McAllister, the popular civics teacher and student government advisor at Carver High, who teaches his kids about the difference between ethics and morals. Jim has a bete noire, a hyper-ambitious young student named Tracy Flick, that's Reese Witherspoon, who's hell-bent on being elected student body president. Jim wants to stop her and begins by convincing a Keanu-ish jock, Paul Metzler, to run against her. Soon, Paul's lesbian younger sister has joined the race too, and caught up in a mad momentum he's somehow unleashed, Jim himself spins out of control and cannonballs into a disastrous act of adultery. Meanwhile, back at school, the tireless Tracy continues to put up posters that say "Pick Flick," continues to raise her hand in class, she invariably knows all the answers, and continues to smile at everyone with a saccharine insincerity that makes you want to smack her. Here she discovers that Paul Metzler has decided to oppose her in the election, and she confronts him in the school hallway.
Who put you up to this?
Oh, hi, Tracy.
Who put you up to this?
What do you mean?
You just woke up this morning and suddenly decided to run for president?
No. I just thought that,
Thought what?
Well, I was talking to Mr. McAllister about my leg and how I still want to do something for the school, and...
So Mr. McAllister asked you to run?
Well, I talked to him and everything, but he just said that he thought it would be a good idea and how there's all different kinds of fruits and, well, it's nothing against you, Tracy. I mean, you're the best. I just thought,
Okay. You're on, Mr. Popular.
You might think it upset me that Paul Metzler had decided to run against me, but nothing could be further from the truth.
Election was directed and co-written by Alexander Payne, who has quietly emerged as one of our best filmmakers, a 90s version of Preston Sturges or Billy Wilder. His debut, Citizen Ruth, was a laugh-out-loud satire about abortion rights that skewered pro-choice and pro-life activists with equal glee. Election is even better, funnier, deeper, more alive with playful flourishes. And it brims with classic Hollywood artistry. The jokes are immaculately timed, the performance is pitch perfect, the ending cynical and slightly corrupt, just like the movies of Sturges and Wilder. Malicious but not hateful, Payne knows how to anchor caricatures in the real world. I had the good fortune to go to public high school in Omaha and can attest to the lethal accuracy of his details. The queasy light in the school building, the simmering class resentment, the self-parodic earnestness of the school principal, and the boneheaded decency of so many pampered young jocks. Election captures truths I've never before seen on screen. For instance, the secret contempt that good teachers feel for those classroom go-getters who study hard in order to get A's rather than to learn, and who run for class office as a means of self-promotion. It's this contempt that ultimately triggers the guerrilla war between Jim and Tracy, two confused souls beautifully played by Broderick in his first middle-aged role, and Witherspoon, a young actress who can seemingly do anything. By the end, the affable Jim discovers that he's neither as ethical nor as happy as he once believed, while Tracy turns out to be a touchingly Nixonian overachiever who puts together the high school yearbook but can't find anyone who will sign it. Back in the 60s, Eastern European directors had a knack for taking an ordinary event, like a boxing contest or fireman's ball, and making it a prism which could reflect a whole culture. That's precisely the trick Payne pulls off in Election, which for all its breeziness is a far richer movie than pictures like Happiness or Fargo, which keep telling you how smart they are. Payne's film is at once a biting satire, a teen comedy complete with dirty jokes, a sly commentary on American politics, and given what I've just said, an unexpectedly compassionate look at the perversity and melancholy that underlies daily life. In a week dominated by high school horror, this terrific comedy has more to say about high school life and America itself than all those pundits talking nonstop about the sick soul of our culture.
John Powers is film critic for Fresh Air and Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by Duke Ellington. Next Thursday is the centennial of his birth. This is the Ellington composition Very Special from the 1962 Money Jungle session, featuring Charles Mingus on bass, Max Roach on drums, Duke Ellington at the piano.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, playwright David Hare. He has two shows on Broadway. One stars Judi Dench. The other is a one-man show in which Hare makes his stage debut. Also, Michael Cerveris and Stephen Trask from the off-Broadway rock musical Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Join guest host Ken Tucker for the next Fresh Air.